Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
And Fred is also the webmaster for the esteemed Creation Research Society. And Fred, today we're talking about Saturn, huh?
Saturn.
Wow, it's from an article in Creation Magazine. And this is put out by Creation Ministries International out of Australia. And online, they're creationontheweb.com. And this is their November 2008 edition. So, Fred, Saturn is an extraordinary planet. For one, it's a lot bigger than the Earth, and it has these awesome rings around it.
Yeah, and evolution scientists don't know why it's there.
Why is it there? Not only why are the rings there, but why is the planet there?
Well, here's a quote out of the article, Bob. For scientists who spend time thinking about how planets form, life would be simpler if gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn didn't exist.
If they didn't exist. Now, that's a creation quote, right? That quote comes from a creationist. Actually, no, it doesn't, does it? That quote comes from space.com, which is a typical evolutionary, Darwinist, naturalist, atheistic worldview science source, very popular worldwide, space.com. And they say, for scientists who spend time thinking about how planets form, life would be simpler if gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn didn't exist. When they try to figure out how would a solar system form from a cloud of gas, a nebula, gradually condensing, these gas giants, they shouldn't be there. They should all be sucked into the sun.
That's right. They call it the migration problem. They should have migrated into the sun billions of years ago.
Yeah, and so it doesn't work. And this is true in so many ways with so many ideas, like how would a star evolve? You know, the classic model of star formation, only it doesn't work because it just doesn't work.
It doesn't match any of the physics. It reminds me, Bob, of the moon. They don't know why the moon's there. And I just love that quote one guy said in Nature magazine. Again, this is an evolutionist.
Right.
He said, the best explanation for the moon is observational error. The moon does not exist.
and he's joking. There are four or five major theories for how the moon got there. And the reason there are four or five is because none of them work. And so he's joking and saying, well, it doesn't exist. It's like an error in your telescope. You look up, you see the moon, it's not there. It's just an observational error. But those theories, they can't figure out how the moon got there. And we spent, what, $20 billion on the lunar missions and the Apollo missions, lunar landers, and they don't have a clue how the moon got there. Every idea, like it was just floating by in space and the gravity of the Earth captured it, well, then its orbit would be way elongated and nothing like it. Be way more elliptical than the perfect orbit that the moon has.
Or it broke off of Earth and, you know, went into orbit.
Right. And all these ideas have been, you know, quantified and checked with equations and simulations, and it just doesn't work.
And it doesn't even come close to working.
No. So, and that's the closest thing to us. We don't have a clue how the moon got there.
Yeah, that's
how did our solar system form? How did a star, any star? In fact, the publisher of, was it Nature magazine? Maddox, I think his name was. He was the editor for 20 years or so. And he wrote a book after he retired, The Things That Remain to Be Discovered. And he said, we don't know what came first, stars or galaxies. So if you think you've heard about the Big Bang and you think that the atheists have figured it all out, they have not figured it all out. They can't tell you how the moon got there, how our solar system formed, what comes first, stars or galaxies. If they don't know that, they don't know how stars form. They don't know how galaxies form. And the Big Bang, of course, is ludicrous. So, Fred,
and we have an eyewitness account, don't we, Bob?
We have an eyewitness account of the Creator God who made the universe.
That's right.
And the heavens declare the glory of God.
And I think the moon came on day 4.
The moon came on day 4. That's right.
And the sun, too.
the sun and the moon and the stars were made.
Now, I know on old earthers, they try to say that, you know, the sun was there for millions of years and that the clouds cleared and then you could see it on day four.
That's that Hugh Ross guy. Hugh Ross, Reasons to Believe. They think that, yeah, they're just wrong. They say, oh, we believe in the Bible, but the global flood didn't happen. And the days of Genesis were in a different order.
And that's right. You know, each day was millions of years. It was really an era of time. So too bad for the plants on day three for not having sunlight till day four, millions of years later.
So anyway, yeah, God gave us a record in his word of creation, the order that he created things. And Saturn, Fred, this is a big planet. Saturn is 750 times bigger than the Earth.
That's massive.
I got to imagine that's massive, right? And it's the sixth planet out from the sun. So I went to public school. Before that, I went to private school. So I think I remember Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. After that, Uranus and Neptune.
And then what's after that? Is there nothing after that, right? Because something happened here recently.
Poor Pluto. Pluto got demoted. Pluto's no longer a planet. I mean, we got people in the studio audience. Al, was Pluto a planet when you were in school? He said it was a planet. It's not a planet anymore.
Is Pluto written out of Disney, too?
Yeah, boy. And that's where they named that character, that dog, Pluto.
Yep.
They named it because Pluto had just been discovered. Anyway, poor Pluto. Poor Pluto. But so Saturn is this massive planet, and it shouldn't be there by evolution. By the way, Fred, it's rings. It has these gorgeous rings. Right now, there's a picture of Saturn right in front of us from NASA.
It's amazing.
It is startling.
Google on, you know, Saturn NASA pictures, and you'll get some pretty amazing.
They look like they're artist rendition.
That's right. They do. Yeah, they look like that, but they're not.
They're so perfect. They're real photos, and Saturn has the shepherd moons that help keep the rings in place. And if they made a model of Saturn, now we said how big it is, right? It's just enormous, like, I don't know what, 70,000 miles in diameter or something like that. If they made a model of Saturn the size of, say, Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles, the rings would be as thin as a sheet of paper. That's how thin the rings are. It's remarkable, right? It is remarkable. And I'd like to add a quote. Okay, you had your quote from space.com.
Okay.
All right, my quote comes from another evolutionary source, and this is Astronomy and Astrophysics, one of their press releases back in 2006, way back in the dark ages. They said theories predict that the giant planets will merge into the central star before planets have time to form. Actually, they said protoplanets. Theories predict that the giant protoplanets, like the mass that would become a planet.
They love to use those kind of words. The evolutionists. Yeah, all these illusionary words like primitive and ancestral and proto and all that. And to try to give the illusion of evolution.
Yeah, that's right. Well, protoplanets, there's no such thing as a protoplanet. But their theories predict that if you did have a giant protoplanet, it would merge into the central star before planets have time to form. This makes it very difficult to understand how they can form at all. And so this, you know, physics and gravity, thermodynamics, entropy, some of these things are the most basic fundamental laws of science, and they're reasonably well understood. And you apply them just with the brute force of mathematical equations. And so if you had a star, a gas cloud, and it was condensing, and you have these massive planets, they're going to get sucked into the star. They're not going to stay out where Jupiter is and where Saturn is.
Yeah, it makes no sense. But, you know, Bob, I did see a Star Trek episode where they got proton torpedoes from protoplanets.
Is that where they got those things?
I just made that up.
Oh, you made that up. The proton torpedoes. So the evolutionists, the atheists, the naturalists, and we call them evolutionists even when we're talking about people who discuss the Big Bang and star evolution. They use those terms, star evolution, star formation, and the solar system evolved. And so we know we're not talking about biology. We're talking about astronomy, but it's the same godless Darwinist materialist worldview.
It's storytelling. That's kind of why I had my storytelling hat on there for a moment. You know, just practicing, trying to act like an evolutionist and just, you know, just they really can't explain stuff. And a lot of times they do make stuff up.
Well, Isaac Newton addressed the question of how is it that the planets go around the sun the way they do? And he said, because the author of the system desired it so. So here's Isaac Newton, by most accounts, the greatest scientist known to man. And, you know, he helps us figure out that there's universal gravity. That was a pretty good accomplishment. He helps us figure out what color is. Imagine trying to figure out color.
All the great scientists of the past were creationists. Almost all of them were Bible-believing Christians.
For the most part, the vast majority of the founders of the physical sciences, even after Darwin, so many of the big names rejected evolution, Darwinism, and believed that God created, as God says in his word. Well, Isaac Newton said, look, there's no other cause. Descartes, remember Descartes? He thought it was a gas cloud that condensed. And Isaac Newton said, no, in my system with gravity and all, it wouldn't do that. You wouldn't have these planets going around the sun.
Well, Bob, I think it's worth one more quote. I got to trump you. You know, pull the, you know, you just planted a tree bigger than mine.
Yeah.
So let me read a third one that.
You just planted a tree bigger than mine. Go ahead.
Okay. So again, this is from, you know, evolutionists. Mm-hmm. Talk about a major embarrassment for planetary scientists. They're there, blazing away in the late evening sky, are Jupiter and Saturn, the gas giants that account for 93% of the solar system's planetary mass, and no one has a satisfying explanation of how they were made. Okay. We have a satisfying explanation.
Yeah, God made them. God made them. He put the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets in the sky to show his glory, his majesty. And Fred, that comes from a creationist. That's a creationist quote, right? No, it isn't. It's from Science Magazine 2002. So Science, that's an evolutionary, Darwinist, godless science magazine. They say it's a major embarrassment. You look up in the evening sky, and by the way, for the last month, Fred, my kids and I, we've been looking at, in fact, last week, the moon, and there was Mars and Jupiter. It was awesome. They formed a triangle.
Oh, wow.
It was just awesome. And Jupiter and Mars have been bright and brilliant in the southwestern sky for a month.
Were you able
now.
To see it with your naked eye, or did you have the telescope?
No. Naked eye. It was just brilliant. Okay. Absolutely brilliant. And that, I don't think that'll come back for another 20 years or so, that particular formation of those three heavenly bodies. So here's Science Magazine saying it's a major embarrassment. Jupiter and Saturn, they make up 93% of the solar system's mass, the planetary mass, the planets. And we don't know how they were made. Well, Fred, they don't know how the moon got there. They don't know how Jupiter and Saturn got there. They can't explain the formation of a star. The classical model of how a star forms, it doesn't start until it's forming. And it doesn't happen until after other stars exploded. So how did those first stars get there to explode? And how did you get your star forming? That's what they cheat. They just cheat. And they don't know what came first, stars or galaxies. And the superstructures in the universe are too large for gravity to form them in the short 15 billion years since the Big Bang, supposedly.
Well, you know, a common theme through all these shows that we do, Bob, is that God at every turn thwarts the naturalistic explanation. Mm. We see it all the time, constantly, and we see it up in the heavens.
Yeah, the way God created, he didn't leave room for a plausible explanation that there might be no God.
That's right. Everything that's presented by evolutionists is ultimately built on illusion, and that's what we try to show the audience on this on these programs.
That is so great. Okay, Fred, so what other articles should we talk about in Creation Magazine?
Well, the next one that I pulled open here is called Evolution, an Ancient Pagan Idea.
All right.
So, you know, some things, you know, things never change under the sun. That was a famous quote by who, Bob?
Solomon, 3,000 years ago.
All right. Well, here's an interesting quote from a Roman naturalist, Pliny the Elder.
Oh, that troublemaker.
He lived from AD 23 to 79, so he probably said this around in the 70s.
All right, so the time the Apostle Paul was ministering and writing.
That's right. And he wrote, we are so subject to chance that chance herself takes the place of God. She proves that God is uncertain. So here you have a first century evolutionist, and again, it's interesting. Like,
chance.
Yeah, chance. They equate this to chance.
Right.
How you can look at something as complex as life and say that that's chance. It's more, just imagine the building that you're in or the car you're driving in when you're listening to the show and you think that a tornado went through Detroit and formed your car.
Mm-hmm.
God, and what's interesting about Pliny the Elder saying this, it's about the same time that Paul was writing his epistles. For example, Romans 1. What did Paul say in Romans 1?
Oh, that the creation shows us that there is a God.
That's
overwhelmingly,
right.
So that you're without excuse.
His invisible attributes are clearly seen.
Clearly seen. The evidence is clearly seen that there is a creator God.
So when an evolutionist on Judgment Day is before God, will he have an excuse? Maybe a small one. Maybe like, well, isn't DNA similar between chimps and humans by 97%? Is that an excuse, Bob?
No, that's not.
It's not. It's built on illusion. Everything's built on illusion. It's common sense. My son can tell you and look at an ape and look at a human and say, hey, we're not related. He's not my great.
Right.
You know, we don't have a great granddaddy that him and I share.
In fact, Fred, they used to say we were 99% similar, and that percentage has been going down. The more they study the human genome, they realize the more different we are than apes. But let's say it's 95% similar. There are millions of differences between apes and humans, and they tell us that we branched off, you know, Australopithecus, Lucy, what was she, 4 million years, whatever she was, a few million years ago. And we have evolution, they say, happens so slowly you can't see it. Well, how have millions of changes happened in just a few million years? And each change went through the entire population. They'd have to go like lightning speed to propagate those mutations through the whole population to get from a 3-foot ape to human beings in such a short amount of time.
And mathematics shows it's impossible. In fact, an evolutionist named Haldane, he was a Marxist too, he showed that at most you could get maybe a couple thousand changes over 10 million years.
A couple thousand changes, because let's say you...
And he was using amazingly conservative assumptions for evolution. So assumptions that aren't true.
Right.
He had to use overly conservative. And all he could come up with was between, you know, roughly 1,600 changes over 10 million years.
So, Fred, in other words, you're married, right? You have kids.
Married, 2 kids.
Are they mutated? Are they mutants?
Well,
hopefully not, right?
Hopefully not.
Let's say one of my kids had a mutation.
Well, they have a genetic load. We all do. We have mutations. We're deteriorating over time. That's
the
thing.
We're not getting better.
Difference.
We're deteriorating.
That's right.
Right. But let's say one of my kids had a mutation that just became a fad. Everybody wanted it. Well, other people are not going to get it unless he gets married and has kids.
That's right.
And then if his kids inherit that mutation...
And only 50%. Well, right away, you've got a 50% barrier based on how genetics and Punnett squares
right.
and all that
so
stuff
So let's
work.
Say he has 2 kids. One will get it. If he has 4 kids, 2 may get it. If he has 1 kid, it'll die out right there. But if he has 4 kids and 2 of his kids get the mutation, and then if they have 2 kids, we're now talking 40 years later, you might have 4 people with this mutation.
And they have to actually have kids and pass it on, and not everybody
right.
has kids. And,
no.
And then over time, what this guy, Haldane, showed is that there's a reproductive capacity. There's only so many kids you can have, and you know, and there's a speed limit to how fast these mutations can move through
right,
the population.
Guess what? Other kids are having... kids too. Other
That's
kids
right.
are growing up and having kids, and your genetic mutation is competing with the rest of the population.
Yeah, and essentially everybody who doesn't have that genetic mutation and all his offspring and all their offspring have to die out. They have to somehow eventually be removed from the population.
Right. So let's say Oriental eye shapes are better, or Caucasian eye shapes are better, and eventually the human race is just going to have one. Okay, when is that going to happen? In the next 300 years? I mean, you could only get so many mutations to go through the entire genome.
And they have to be beneficial. They have to be something that's recognized by natural selection. But natural selection can't pick a mutation. It only can pick an individual. Yet all these individuals are also suffering harmful mutations. How does it even see
the
mutation,
that's beneficial?
In fact, there's an article at the end of this magazine by a guy named Dr. Stanford. I'd highly recommend his book called Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome. I highly recommend that book. He gave an analogy which I thought was really good, and it's the princess and the pea, where the princess is on a bed and there's a pea under at the very bottom of it, but she can never feel it because there's so much in between it. There's so much apparatus
between
where you would never,
and the pea.
Selection would never be able to even detect a beneficial mutation.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the illusion of 97%, 95% similarity. That's all it is an illusion. We've got 3 to 4 billion nucleotides. So if we're different by 3%, let's even just go with 3% and give the evolutionists a break. That's still 90 million base pairs that have to be fixed in a population, if, you know, if we evolved from some chimp-like ancestor 10 million years ago.
Let's say fish that produce thousands of eggs. And so one of those fish out there has the one evolutionary mutation that the world had been waiting for a million years. And it gets eaten by another fish. Never reproduces. Well, then another million years later, there's that one fish with that one good mutation. And it's in one of its eggs, but it lays like 3,000 eggs. And 98% of those eggs get eaten up within a day. Has nothing to do with any beneficial survival rate. It's just an egg.
That's right. And you know what? Evolutionists, they have a hero that could come to the rescue. It's those house flies, right? Because they reproduce rapidly, so you don't have to wait a long time. And so they mutate these things like crazy. Well, what happens over time, Bob? What happens to these flies?
They stay flies.
They turn into flies, mutated flies, some that can't fly.
And we have seen millions of generations in laboratories of bacteria, and they stay bacteria.
And they cannot evolve anything. What happens is they actually de-evolve.
They de-evolve. They might end up being able to eat plastic, but they're less efficient than before they got the mutation so that they could eat plastic.
Well, even the ones that ate plastic, there was pretty good evidence that was a non-random mutation, and non-random mutations imply design, that there was a mechanism in place. Yeah. And that's a whole other story. But Neo-Darwinism says that non-random mutations are not part of their theory. They don't happen.
That's right, because they base evolution on random chance, then selected by nature. Okay,
that's
now,
right.
Could we go to this article about the Ark, Noah's Ark. Fred, this is so exciting. Noah's Ark has been found, and it's in the Netherlands. It's in Holland. Well, I guess it's not quite Noah's Ark, but this Johan Hubers, he is a neat guy. I like what he's done.
Oh, yeah. He built an Ark replica, and apparently it's drawing a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Which is what you want it to do.
And it's not only a replica of an Ark, it's big.
It's huge, but not quite as big as the real Ark.
No, it's like a little less than half size, 1/5 the volume, but it actually is seaworthy, and he takes it all through the Netherlands. He made it the size that he needed to so he could traverse the inland waterways and get under bridges. And so, but it's still massive. I got the dimensions right here. This Ark is 230 feet long and 43 feet high. That's big for a boat. It looks just like the modern models of Noah's Ark. And
yeah,
Fred,
based on descriptions in the Bible.
Right. And so he takes it all over through the Netherlands, and he's using it to share the gospel of Jesus Christ with people.
That's right. And, you know, the Ark is a good way to witness to people. I remember getting in conversation at where I used to work a couple years ago about Noah's Ark and how do you get all the animals on there and this and that. And it offers you the opportunity to get in a good conversation with people and defend Scripture. For example, South Korean ship architects have created a model of the Ark, and they were not able to capsize it.
Based on the dimensions in Genesis.
The dimensions in the Bible.
Given by God to Noah.
That's right. They could not capsize it. They used the Tsunami from several years ago and multiplied it by several times. They could not capsize this boat. It was built for stability. And when you look at other accounts of the ark from other cultures, like the Babylonian account, it's of an ark that's either not seaworthy, or the, I think the Babylonian account was one that was seaworthy, but it was cube-shaped and, like, I think 7 stories tall. A cube-shaped boat would spin endlessly. Would you want to be on a boat that's spinning constantly for a year, Bob?
No, right. God is the designer of the eye, the muscles on top of the eye, everything else in the universe. And he knew how to tell Noah, here's how to build a seaworthy vehicle. So
he didn't build a speedboat or anything like that. He built it perfectly for stability. And again, ship architects cannot sink this thing.
So Johann Huber's, he said, in the past, people in Europe went to church. Nowadays, they don't. So he invites them to come on his ark, and he shares the gospel of Jesus Christ with them. That is exciting. Fred, we have time only for one last story. Could we mention the fossils of the jellyfish that are being found? And Darwin, I think, he implied that you'd never find a fossil of a jellyfish. Why would he say that?
Well, jellyfish are kind of soft, aren't they, Bob?
Yeah, they're very soft.
So if sediments of sand are being laid down, you know, slowly over millions of years, how would you ever get a jellyfish buried in dirt and
so
mud?
Darwin said, quote, no organism wholly soft can be preserved, unquote. Well, it turns out that he's wrong because...
Shocker there.
Because their model of fossil formation, they ignored the catastrophic flood, the global flood, which formed the vast majority of all fossils rapidly. And so there's actually a picture, Fred, in here on this exceptionally preserved jellyfishes article that they say the evolutionists, it's just funny. This is comes from the Public Library of Science, what very well-known science evolution source. They say that this was covered up with very fine sediments, layer upon layer upon layer. And that's how this jellyfish was preserved. Fred, did they ever look at the picture? I mean, it's upright.
It's standing on its tentacles.
How can it be dead and stand on its tentacles in place during this process that takes months and years and decades? It's just so silly.
Well, you know the freeze tag game your kids play. He said, I'm going to play freeze tag and just stay there and stay with all my tentacles firm
for
and let myself be buried.
Yeah, for 400 years. So
it kind of looks like to me, Bob, maybe this thing might have been buried rapidly.
Yeah,
is that maybe
rapidly,
the best explanation?
Just like that quarry near Milwaukee where they found 7 layers, 12 feet thick of rock, 7 different strata. Of one school of jellyfish, all fossilized.
It's amazing. How many years did it take for that to happen?
They said it was 1 million years of deposition, the geologist, and here's one school of jellyfish that gets caught up in it. It didn't take 1 million years for those layers. It happened rapidly. But we know that because the Bible tells us that. So, Fred Williams, thank you for joining me another episode of Real Science Friday.
Oh, it was fun, Bob.
Hey, if somebody wants to help Bob and your life stay on the air, for $100, we'll send you this. Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning, the 8th edition. It's 150 pages more, fabulous, color photos, great science information than his last edition. But we'll also send you a copy of the 7th edition. You give that as a gift. You keep the 8th edition, and we'll send you Walt Brown Week, a great CD hearing Walt talk through creation and evolution. Our phone number, 800-8-NER. Please help us out. $100. We'll give you this gift. May God bless you.